Good afternoon, Mr. Bosman, Ms. Hobbs. Do you want to reserve any call?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may, let's reserve 2 minutes.
Two? That's fine, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of Clifton Harris. Mr. Harris comes before this court asking that the decision of the trial court be reversed on all grounds appealed from, which would include the assignments of error res judicata, the court's conclusion of law that Dr. Harris could have or should have raised the claim for fraud and the inducement within 21 days, the denial of his the dismissal of his action based on the alternative grounds of laches, and finally the dismissal of his action based on the trial court's conclusion that there was a contractual waiver which precluded him from asserting fraud and inducement. It's important for the court to rule on all those grounds because one can always contemplate a circumstance where the matter could be remanded and then he might be able to assert his remedies or amend his prayer for relief in the trial court. So I would restart by reminding the court or calling to the court's attention and emphasizing that Dr. Harris here asked as part of his complaint for rescission that the court reopen the divorce proceeding and then set aside the agreement based upon fraud and the inducement within the context, the broader context of reopening the divorce case, therefore allowing him to directly challenge that significant aspect, an integral aspect of the court's decision. Of the court's decision to grant the divorce, which incorporated but not merged the party's agreement into the divorce. If the affirmation and ratification of the party's agreement, but not without the added aspect of merging.
But your allegation of fraud is that the wife didn't disclose all of her debts.
That's one of the allegations. Yes.
And what's the other allegation of fraud?
That she had an affirmative duty under the parties as a condition precedent to the contract to do so, and during...
To make full disclosure.
To make full disclosure. That was mandated, and that's absolutely clear as a matter of law at this stage of the proceedings. And the further fraudulent actions were that she affirmatively, as pled on these facts, after the agreement was signed, and even during the pendency of the proceedings, right up until several months after the divorce was final and set in stone, she actively concealed her fraudulent, deceitful non-disclosure.
Well, counsel, what about paragraph 21 of the property settlement agreement, disclosure of assets and debts? Doesn't that have a remedy even if there is not full disclosure? Isn't that the remedy? Isn't your client limited to that remedy?
No. And the reason is because there's a condition proceeding to the contract here. The presupposition that the parties entered into this contract is that they did make full disclosure. And this goes beyond the statutory standard of just merely fair and reasonable disclosure. She said, I'm making full disclosure.
Well, they recognize that paragraph said each of the parties recognize that he or she has received full disclosure of the assets and liabilities. Each party acknowledges that he or she has had ample opportunity to verify the debts and liabilities. And if there is failure to disclose, then paragraph 25 lists the remedies.
Well, paragraph 25 also says the following, Your Honor. The parties hereto declare that each has made full disclosure to the other of all his or her assets, income, and liabilities. As the Nationwide case says, and as I argue extensively in the reply brief, you can't waive your liability. You can't make a contract with your fingers crossed behind your back. You can't say, I'm making full disclosure. You're relying on that and entering into the broader contract. Therefore, you can keep your fingers crossed behind your back, and still get the benefit of your bargain. The Nationwide case is very clear, as I've argued in the rebuttal brief. You cannot waive your liability for fraud. You can't say, I've committed fraud, but ha-ha, it's too bad for you. You know, thumbing your nose at the other party. I was artful and deceitful enough
to conceal. Can I ask you on that, though? I mean, it's not a question of you can't do that. I mean, but what about now, you know, 4 years later, after it's left the jurisdiction of the circuit court? Is your argument that essentially the fraud that occurred was so, the precedent fraud was so bad that it was a fraud upon the court, that it
yes.
was extrinsic fraud?
It is extrinsic fraud. And the Supreme Court tells us that fraud in the inducement is extrinsic fraud. You have these two very powerful concepts here that are very much in play. And this court has, what I'm urging the court to do is reconcile them and create and distinguish this particular case from the general rule that the court has previously clearly set forth in the Ellett case. Yes, we understand on a level of generality that in almost virtually every case, if you don't raise the fraud and the inducement within 21 days, then you're precluded from attacking making an independent action for rescission later on. However, that is a understandable desire on the part of the judicial system to create finality here. But this case really is different because there, as pled, what Dr. Harris seeks to do is simply get his day in court to argue that these were material non-disclosures, that this was essential to the contract, and that her fraud and her active concealment of the fraud during the ongoing and the pendency of the divorce prevented him from learning that. He just wants this opportunity to get that argument. He doesn't want to be precluded from it by a complete invidious, inexorable operation of the 21-day rule and this rule in Ellett. There's no indication in Ellett. I mean, Ellett was sustained under demur, and in this case, this is just a plea and bar to one issue, res judicata. As the trial court said, even though I tried to argue otherwise, but the trial court said, and I do agree at this point, it wasn't a demur. He didn't rule on the insufficiency of Dr. Harris's pleadings. He merely said, with regard to the res judicata issue, you just can't even raise this.
Counsel, you relied heavily on the Pete case, and the trial court relied on Ellett, but didn't cite Pete.
I raised Pete to the trial court.
What do you make of that?
What do I make of that? With all due respect to the trial judge, he overinterpreted the Ellett case and didn't see the factors that distinguish it from the instant case. And also, what I make of it is that it's simply the trial court ignored the implications of the Pete case. Clearly, fraud and the inducement can be extrinsic fraud. Clearly. Sometimes fraud and the inducement could be intrinsic if it was something that was known to the party seeking to set aside the agreement or should have been reasonably known at the time the divorce was in process. Here, as pled, Dr. Harris clearly says she artfully and deceitfully concealed her fraud from me and then continued to do it during the pendency of the divorce process. And then only after the ink was dry and the 21-day period had run, there was no available remedy for recourse, did he start then to learn incrementally how she had made these material misrepresentations. And she even, as pled, this has to be taken as true for purposes of these proceedings, Laura Harris continued making payments on the credit card that she didn't disclose to him. And then only many months after the divorce decree was finalized did she then stop making payments on those credit cards and then went into a bankruptcy. And then he found out, oh, she's concealed that from me. And then he found out later that she continued to take out loans. She had even taken a loan out on his Genworth or MetLife financial policy after the divorce was finalized. I mean, all of these, if taken as true, indicate that there was really, she actively took steps during the pendency of the divorce process to continue the deception. It would be a terribly invidious proposition for this court to say, if the person perpetrating the fraud is so artful and so inexorable and so persistent in it that they prevent the innocent victim, in this case Dr. Harris, from discovering that fraud, that he has no remedy.
So you're the rule that you propose should be the court's view of this, and the rule that we should implement is that if there were fraud, if there is fraud,
extrinsic fraud,
and it was concealed and wasn't discovered until more than 21 days after the trial court entered the final order and the divorce decree, that regardless of what the fraud is, if it affected any terms of it, of that property settlement agreement or anything in the divorce decree, that it has to be extrinsic fraud. Is that, understanding your argument?
Yes, but you're stating it a little bit too broadly. It doesn't, it could be extrinsic fraud. In this case, he wants to be able to argue on these facts at a merits hearing that it is extrinsic fraud and that it was material and that he has a remedy, especially in light of the promise that she made to him, and that's memorialized in the contract, and that the court relied upon when Laura Harris presented it to the court, that she had made full disclosure.
Was there any discovery conducted during this case?
I can tell you there wasn't, but although the appellee argues, he could have gone and done it, he's not under an obligation to do it. And the cases I've cited in the reply brief, the Nationwide case, and the others make clear, once she makes these promises as a condition preceding to the contract and memorializes them in the contract, he is under no duty under Virginia law under the Nationwide case to go ferret out the fraud. She says, he could have discovered it. Well, why? He trusted her because she gave him his word and put it in a contract. I mean, she gave him her word and memorialized it in a contract. The burden shifts to her. This is distinguishable from those cases where if the agreement was silent and there was no affirmative requirement of full disclosure, as there is here, yes, he would be out of luck without a remedy.
So you said that's why it's a fraud upon the court, why it's extrinsic fraud, because the agreement requires that and it wasn't discovered or likely discoverable until it was final.
Not quite. You could have an extrinsic fraud where you knew or should have known or had a duty to ferret out the non-disclosures. If, for example, as I've explained in the case law in the reply brief, were the agreement silent and there were no affirmative duty of full disclosure, not just fair and reasonable disclosure, but full disclosure, then if he did not act, he could not later come back and claim, I'm a victim of extrinsic fraud.
But isn't that paragraph just almost a boilerplate paragraph that goes in agreements? Can you imagine an agreement that didn't say we've disclosed all these things, assets and liabilities? I can't imagine a property settlement agreement.
I actually can.
You can?
Because the statutory standard here is fair and reasonable disclosure. And the boilerplate language I see a lot is the parties have made fair and reasonable disclosure. But if they've inadvertently omitted some minor asset, then that's undisclosed. Then they have a remedy where they can simply go back to court and seek relief under the contract based on that one remedy. This is different. This full disclosure was a material and substantial term of the contract. And
these weren't just... Weren't a lot of these debts also debts that were in his name?
If the 33-page vermin of facts are carefully read and taken in the light most favorable to Dr. Harris, yes, perhaps some of them were in her name, and is also averred that perhaps she applied for credit cards in his name, racked up the debts, and affirmatively did not disclose that fact to him and concealed it from him. Remember, the facts as pled say, she didn't tell him about all the credit cards, and she kept making payments on the credit cards after they signed the agreement, while the divorce was pending, and for a few months after the divorce was completed. So why shouldn't he get his day in court on extrinsic fraud if somebody goes to that level of deceit and artifice to conceal these facts from them? I mean, this is a very narrow exception to Ellett, and I'm not suggesting the general principle in Ellett shouldn't be respected in 98% of these cases, but it cannot foreclose him a remedy where there's literally been tens of thousands of dollars in financial damages to him because of her fraudulent non-disclosures. that simply can't be the case, and he simply has to have a remedy. I mean, she plundered his life insurance policies and concealed that fact from him. She stole from the practice, which he didn't even learn until many years later, thereby depleting the marital estate. He wants his day in court. This is extrinsic fraud upon the court. He asked the court to reopen the divorce case, which distinguishes it from Ellett, and specifically rescind the agreement, which was ratified and affirmed by the court, but not merged into the final decree, of divorce. So, short of bringing an action to set aside the entire divorce, what else would the court have him do? Except say, the reward, if you allow this decision to stand, it's essentially
saying, Mr. Bosserman, your time is up, and you've also eaten up your rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Kelly Hobbs, and I represent the appellee in this case. Excuse me. I think this case boils down to one issue, and it's res judicata. He filed this 33-page motion. I filed a plea and bar based on the Ellett case. And by the way, I think this is the Ellett case. It's strikingly similar. Notwithstanding what Mr. Bosserman would have you believe, both parties were aware prior to the entry of the divorce decree that there were other debts that were not included within the agreement. And that is contained, that information is contained in the 33-page complaint. If you look on page 11 in my reply brief, I cite you to several areas in the appendix where he says in his pleading, Clifton did open this account 1 year during Christmas season. So this American Express Optima credit card account was open. He was aware of these two debts that he now claims he's unaware of, bless you,
thank you.
At the time, and yet he did nothing to inform Ms. Harris about it because it wasn't in the agreement. He didn't even apparently get a credit card check on himself, a credit report check. And if he didn't take even that tiny little bit of an effort to determine what in the world is out there, then I don't think it's up to this court to correct his mistake that was made 4 years ago. In addition, the clauses, paragraph 21 and paragraph 25, are indeed boilerplate, and their intent is to provide a remedy in the event somebody says, whoops, here's a credit card that we didn't know about. How are we going to handle this? It allows for them to divide it equally between them, or however they want to do it. If they can't agree, go to the court and get equitable distribution that way. All of this is, I think, we're wandering around in the tall weeds, and I've thought that since I got this brief. This is the Ellett case. It's a res judicata. I actually filed my plea and bar also based on statutory limitation because he used the fraud word so many times. I thought, well, just in case I'm wrong and Ellett doesn't control this, there's a statute of limitations on fraud. So if he wants to say fraud in the inducement, he had 2 years. Under the terms of his own pleading, he knew, and I gave him the benefit of the doubt, as late as October of 08, that these things were coming out of the woodwork, all of these debts that he now claims gives him the ability to undo an entire divorce decree that was entered 4 years ago. Sorry, 6 years ago now. He waits until 2012 to file this action. That's after the last Harris versus Harris case was affirmed by this court. So he's way out of time on that. I think talking about laches and that was brought up by the trial court. I think it's clearly laches if you want to go there as an equitable remedy. He waited too long. He knew about it that whole time. We've been in litigation since then. So I think clearly he cannot now ask, and the Ellett case makes it clear, that this court go back and give him a do-over. In Ellett, the primary complaint was that she did not, or she misrepresented the family bills, among other things that he accused her of. This is basically 33 pages of you misrepresented the family bills. I think it's the Ellett case, and I think that the judge made the proper decision. And if you look at his ruling, while he addresses laches and paragraphs 21 and 25, he initially starts out, this is the Ellett case. It is res judicata. Once that decree was entered and 21 days passed and nobody appealed nor perfected an appeal, we're done. That contract is a different animal from any other contract now because it has been subsumed into a divorce decree. It can only be attacked by the use of extrinsic fraud. And extrinsic fraud is a very narrow group. Bribing a juror, bribing a judge, misrepresentation of fact or some other bad behavior on the part of an attorney. And that's not what we have here. There's a reason that you are narrowed down to extrinsic fraud only to attack that decree. Everything he has in here, they're all allegations of intrinsic fraud, for which there is another remedy, and always has been this entire time. So,
is the Pete versus Pete case that he refers to, what's the distinguishing factor there? The daughters weren't allowed to testify? Why is that different?
So that was a charge where he claimed that Barbara, the wife, had committed perjury. And my reading of that case is that the court said, no, she never really said anything untrue. So there was no perjury. That piece that he parses out, counsel parses out five words and then of the end of one sentence and then three at the other, I believe he's trying to make it for the proposition that that would have been extrinsic fraud. I don't think that's what that case stands for. I think what they were trying, the way I read it, is perjury may be a form of extrinsic fraud. I think that's what they're saying. To me, that would be intrinsic because it would have been before the court. It's subject to cross-examination. I mean, it's exactly the kinds of things that Ellett lists. So Pete does not stand for the proposition that what all of these allegations are in the 33-page motion are extrinsic fraud, certainly. I think what they were saying is perjury was extrinsic fraud and that he didn't prove perjury because she never misrepresented facts. She said, I told the daughters not to be here, and they weren't there. And so I think that that's what that case was about. I don't think it speaks to the idea that these allegations are suddenly and magically extrinsic.
The terminology extrinsic and intrinsic, extrinsic means it's collateral or outside of the actual trial process. Intrinsic means it's within the trial process. Is that a
That's the way I looked at it. In addition, though, I think extrinsic is confined to fraud on the court of some sort. Like I said, bribing a jury, bribing a judge.
It's collateral to the issues before the court.
That's right. Yes, sir.
But, of course, his argument, as I understand it, is that the court didn't know when it incorporated that decree that a number of things hadn't been disclosed and went through the whole trial without knowing this information.
There wasn't a trial. I think that's something that maybe counsel has a little problem with. In this case, there was an agreement signed, executed by two adults.
But it was included within order of the court, and the court didn't know at the time
Both parties submitted the agreement and said, hey, we've been separated for more than 1 year. We'd like a divorce based on no fault of grounds. Happens all the time. Please incorporate this agreement into your final decree. Here's your final decree. Please sign it. That happens all the time. That judge never met either one of these people. He could have asked. Could have asked for discovery. He could have asked for a hearing. But he never did. He was in agreement. And as I said, he agreed knowing at that time, because it's in his pleading, in his 33-page pleading, that he was aware of other accounts that had not been dealt with in that agreement, and he chose to go forward. So I guess we could turn it around on him.
What page was that in the...
I've got Appendix 30. I think I've got a couple of different pages in here. There's one on appendix page 35, which should be his brief. One in there, it says, this American Express Optima card account was, and I left out the entire site, so if the court's looking at the appendix, that would fill in that blank, was opened with knowledge of Clifton. So, I mean, he knew that not everything was in that agreement, and it seems to me that we could turn it around and say, well, he knew of things that Mrs. Harris didn't know of, so what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Are we now saying that they both go, well, and by the way, he doesn't have any right to rely on her. It's Barnes versus Barnes. When people are separated from one another and intend to get a divorce. They're adversaries. And the one has no right to rely on the other. In fact, each, according to Barnes, each party has a duty to find out their own issues, their own debts. You can't rely on the other guy. You're clearly adversaries. You're about to get a divorce, no matter how friendly you are. So, I mean, it just seems to me that this is an effort to, and were the court to allow him to do this, I think it would create all kinds of public policy issues. Nobody would ever know when there was a finalization of anything. I think that is exactly the reason why the boilerplate language gets put in there. People make mistakes. Whoops, found a mistake. Let's go. He's claiming it's based on fraud, but we're too many years out. We can't let people wait this long and go. This is exactly why we have the equitable theory of laches and why we have statutory deadlines. You just can't let people come back and do this all these years later. And the intervening time, people have been relying on this agreement. She did, in fact, declare bankruptcy. So we can't unring all of the things that have happened at this point. So I think that in this case, the judge made the right decision, and it was on res judicata. All these other issues that have been and consist of the other three assignments of error brought before this court, I don't think really matter, because once you get to res judicata, you're done. I think this is the Ellett case all over again. The judge made the correct ruling. And for that reason, I would ask the court to consider that this whole appeal had no merit. And I would ask that you remand it for consideration of granting attorney's fees on my client's behalf. Unless there are other questions?
None, thank you.
Your request for attorney's fees is not based on the wording of the agreement. It's just based on O'Loughlin, is that right?
Correct.
You're not relying on the enforcement because it's of the agreement, that sort of thing.
I think I clearly get them under the agreement that these parties signed, sure, but I'm basing that simply on the fact that I don't think there's any merit in this appeal. Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll agree.